Hey, and welcome to FutureThinkers.org, a podcast about the evolution of technology, society, and consciousness. I'm Mike Gilliland.
And I'm Yuvia Ivanova. If you're new to the show and you want to get a list of our favorite books, popular episodes, and to join our community, go to FutureThinkers.org/start. All Future Thinkers episodes are now on video. To watch the premiere of each episode and join the discussion live, subscribe to our YouTube channel at FutureThinkers.org/YouTube. Hey guys, welcome back to part two of our interview with Kevin Kelly, the founding editor of Wired magazine and author of the book The Inevitable. In this part, we focus on the future developments of AI, artificial intelligence, how it will interact with human consciousness, and future career paths related to AI.
You can find all the links and show notes for this episode at futurethinkers.org/85 or in the description of this video. And if you haven't seen the first part yet, go to futurethinkers.org/84.
A quick announcement before we start. Mike and I are working on designing some courses, and we'd like to get feedback from you guys on what you'd like to learn from us. So go to futurethinkers.org/courses and fill out our quick survey. It'll really help us out. Enjoy the episode. A lot of very intelligent people have been talking about the high chances of humanity becoming extinct this century. What do you think about that? Do you think that this is a high probability, and what are the things that could prevent it?
I think it's extremely low probability about the level of getting hit by an asteroid. So if an asteroid hit the Earth, it would be pretty catastrophic. There are people, there's a small group of people, the B16 Foundation of scientists and astronauts who are looking, tracking every single asteroid in the sky. They have calculations about when and if it could hit the Earth, and they have plans what to do if they detect one. I don't know, maybe there's 20, 30, 100 people in total. So that's good. We should fund them. But we shouldn't make policy. This should not enter into any of your plans at all, because the probability is so low that you can ignore it. It shouldn't affect how you make your career. If you have a business, you shouldn't be worried about whether there's going to be an asteroid impact. What will we do? Even if a government, it's just so low. And I would say the same thing about humans disappearing. It's possible, but it's so unlikely. It would be so difficult to happen unnoticed and all of a sudden it's the probability that's not worth worrying about, other than, you know, there should be 100 people worried about AI safety. We're concerned about that. But for most of us, this is not a probability worth paying attention to.
I think you're an interesting person to ask that question to, because of all the different kind of areas of technology that you're looking at and how they're all independently growing and then how they all connect. And I think people who are really concerned with the future, very smart people, like you said, when you kind of investigate them a little more deeply, they seem to be very narrow and not looking at the broad perspective of how maybe we as humanity will solve some of these problems by the kind of unknown unknowns of ways these technologies interact.
I mean, one of the things about, you know, science fiction, which is a kind of future studies, it's a way of rehearsing the future. It's a way of making scenarios of what could be. Most of them are dystopian these days. So I can't even think of a single science fiction movie, other than Star Trek, perhaps, which is not on this planet, but of a movie on this planet where there's a future that you want to live in. It's like, oh, I want to live there. And that's because so it's very difficult to kind of imagine that. This also makes terrible movies because it'd be boring, right? I mean, so the conflict and drama comes from the dystopia. So that's what we get, because they're very good at telling stories. But I think it's important that we have a positive view of the future, because it makes it easier to kind of make it. But it is difficult to imagine a world in which we have ubiquitous AI and ubiquitous tracking and ubiquitous gene editing, and that's a future that we want to live in. But I think it's possible to articulate that. And the idea that humans will disappear, I think, if it's technological, what that doesn't really explain, that scenario doesn't explain is how, why people work on this problem or how this comes about. There's this, the thing about new technologies is that they have all these intermediate versions. They just don't appear. I mean, nothing appears fully and it works. I mean, you have years and years of incremental people trying, you know, even like, you know, VR, they're still trying version after version. It's not going to suddenly one day and then we have this perfectly working VR oasis that everybody's in. You have years and years of the versions where it almost works and you get to think about it and you get to try it. And there's, and the problems are also, we have early versions of the problem. So there isn't this, so we have time to socially adjust to it. And if we don't like what we're seeing, we don't make more of it. And so I think the idea that there's kind of the sudden appearance of technology that works in its intended way and then is against all human values, it's like, that's just not going to happen. There's, who's funding this? And the 20 years of development that it'll take, it doesn't make economic sense. So I'm not worried in that sense. Environmentally, we're much more adaptable. Eliminating life, and even, well, it's impossible. Eliminating human life is possible, but unlikely again, because we can adapt. We can live all kinds of places that you wouldn't think, but travel around the world to some remote places, and there are people living there with very extreme conditions. And so I it's kind of like a romantic idea, really. And the elimination of the death of human species is a romantic idea. It's a fantasy.
So a lot of people fear conscious AI. And one thing you brought up in your book was that it's not going to need to be conscious. You will have very limited, very narrow focused AI that will scale up depending on the needs for the required use. Can you talk a bit more about that, just to explain to our audience what that version of AI looks like?
So the first and most essential step is to make this plural. So they're AIs. It's not just one AI. There's many AIs. Just like there's not one machine, there's machines. We've got all kinds of machines. Each machine is engineered to do something different. There's not just like what is the machine doing? Machines do things. So we have AIs, and all these AIs will be different. They'll be engineered to do different things. They'll have different combination of cognitive skills. They will be smart in one direction and others. And one of the fundamental engineering maxims is that there's no free lunch. You can't optimize every single dimension. That's the difference between reality and fiction. In reality, you can't optimize everything. You can't have the super organism that can jump higher, run faster, be smaller, more flexible than any other organism. Every organism is a real thing and can only optimize in certain things. That's why there's different species. They have different livelihood, different specialties. You can't have a general purpose organism. So there's no general purpose intelligence. There's only specialized intelligence, including ours. Ours is not a general purpose. We have a very specialized intelligence that evolves on this planet to survive in our bodies. And most of the AIs that we will make will be very different from humans. And that's why we're going to make them, because we don't want them to think like humans. You know, we have the AI running Google. It has memorized every single word on every web page in the universe. That's an inhuman feat. And so we want the cars to drive not like humans. So they're going to have a non-human like intelligence that's going to be engineered to drive, and they won't be very good conversationalists. All right. And they may not be very good at translation because they're going to be engineered to drive. So there are going to be probably hundreds, if not thousands, of different species of AI. All of them will think differently than humans. And that is their main benefit and virtue, is they think differently than us, because thinking different is the engine of creation. It's how wealth is made. And when humans are all connected together, when we have constant 24-hour connection with 7 billion other humans, thinking different is going to be a real premium. It's going to be tough to think differently when we're all connected together. So AIs will help us think differently. And so the takeaway is that we're going to engineer them to not have human-like intelligence. They're more like alien intelligence. It's like artificial aliens. They're like aliens from another planet, like Spock, whose value is that he doesn't think the same as us. They'll be creative. AIs can be creative. They can. They may even have a sense of humor, but it's not. It's going to be an alien sense of humor, alien creativity. They're going to create in a different way than us, and that is going to be their virtue. And mostly, they're going to work with us. So what we've discovered is that the teams, the centaur of human plus AI, is more powerful than either the AI by itself or humans by themselves. And so there is this kind of marriage of the two that produces a kind of intelligence that we like. And so the advantage of humans is that we really crave other humans. And when we have a chance, while the AIs can certainly have a conversation at some point, we're still going to tend to want to converse with a human. That will be a premium. We'll pay a little bit more for that. We will generally favor that, and not just a human disembodied, but a human in the full body. That will become more and more precious to us, because we're alike. And as good as the AI can be, they're just going to be a little different. They can kind of fake it, but there's a latency. I mean, the thing about it is that there was all, for sometimes we won't really care if we're going to call up to a reservation to make a in a restaurant. We don't care. I don't care whether it's a human or not. For when they're in the, when there's a movie, is that a CGI character or a real one? I don't really care. It's just a movie. If it's a news article, I care. So it's worth figuring out. So there will always be some way to tell if we care. Sometimes we won't care. Other times we will care. And so if we do care, there are ways to see that, to figure that, and we'll appreciate that. If it doesn't matter, and lots of times it won't matter, the AIs will be, they'll do a great job.
That relates actually to one of the ideas that you talked about in the book, where as more and more things get automated and more things become kind of shared and copied, then it is human experiences that become more valuable.
Yes, right. So one of the things you can't copy in a world where you can make copies very easily is a human experiences. And so that's one of the few things that aren't getting cheaper every year. They're getting more expensive. You know, things like, well, you can get music for free, but a concert, the prices of concert tickets continue to go up, or a four-star meal with the chef. Even things like babysitters, or the prices are rising higher, faster than the inflation, where everything else is getting cheaper. So travel, the kinds of travel experiences where you go and you have this full 3D embodied smells and the whole thing, that will continue to become a premium experience. People willing to pay a lot of money for that. So, yes, I think that when we have, when most things are becoming commodity and cheaper, that experiences, particularly in reality, real life experiences with humans, become one of the most precious things that we'll have, which is good news for people who want to work with other people, for people who like to make human experiences. That's good news because they'll have a job for a very long time.
Yeah. And so do you think that there's something uniquely human that can't be replicated by AI or AIs?
the first thing that can't be replicated are all the things together at once. So I think you'll be able to replicate and optimize individual things. As I was saying, you can engineer things. So like, you know, Google's already, their memory of Google is better than your memory already, but it can't do all these other things too. So what we can't optimize is that kind of holistic package of everything together in one thing. But we can have different AIs that can be better than humans in its individual dimension. So the one thing that humans can do that no AI can do is to offer all those things together in one package. One of the things that I think is going to be a very, very long time is like a sense of humor. So yes, I think AIs will tell jokes, they'll be funny, but they'll have a slightly different sense of humor than us. So, you know, that's actually been a cartoon or a joke in the science fiction community is, you know, the ability of a AI to tell a joke that people would find funny. So I think asking questions is something that for at least a couple of generations, humans will be better at than AI. AIs, if you want a good answer, you're asking a machine. If you want a good question, you hire a human.
That's okay? An excellent.
So I think for the while, and right now AIs don't ask questions because they don't have common sense. They don't know, they don't have a big enough context. That's going to be a long time in coming, but it will come. And but asking really good questions is something that I think humans will be superior for a while, but not, and you know, not over long term. But when they do ask questions, they're going to, again, they're not going to ask them in the same way that we ask them. We may not, we would feel more comfortable with a human question just because our minds will think similarly. So that's the thing I want to emphasize is the AIs can do and achieve these things, but their minds are working differently because they're on silicon. They're not in the analog wetware, which means that there is a difference. There's a qualitative difference. And we, being humans, are very attractive to minds that think just like us. It's kind of like, it's why people of the same nationality hang out because there's a little bit of this kind of like, you've got this thing, you make a joke, they understand exactly right. There's no extra effort. And that's, so there'll be these smart beings all around, just like you're going into the bar scene in Star Wars. There's all these other species. They're all intelligent. They can ask questions and stuff, but you're going to probably want to hang around with other humans. And so that becomes an advantage.
One of the professions of the world could be like an AI curator.
Yes.
So a person that is creating like an immersive experience out of different kinds of AIs for other people.
I think very soon we'll have AI whisperers, which are people who kind of can talk to and understand an AI.
Oh, yeah. Like ask the right questions.
The dog whisperer, the horse whisperers, who kind of just intuitively understand. And so they're kind of like, and there will also be psychologists and psychiatrists for AIs because they will have very similar mental issues. And you'll bring in this AI mental health expert because your AI is like acting really, really weird.
And AI shaman.
Yeah, the AI shaman. So there will be, and there will be, you know, people who have maybe autistic people who have some affinity to the way that the machine intelligence is working, and they can kind of be the in-between person. And there will be other people who, you know, are just collaborate really well with AIs, and they just sort of work together. Maybe they don't even understand them very well, but they're kind of like they're just partners, and they compensate for some reason to creatively compensate for each other, and they're the centaur team that produces paintings or new music?
Yeah, we already do this. I mean, there's a very primitive version of this. So when Mike and I are doing design, we use this one program that helps you choose color palettes. And we set the colors and like the starting colors, and we choose what we like, but then we let it generate more combinations. Sure. And then we're like, oh, we like that one. We like that one. Yeah.
But they could go, of course, much further. They could do the actual design in iterative designs, fully rendered. Yeah. So that's where we're going. Alexa just woke up. So I think, and then there's the repair people. I mean, I think there's a huge job in keeping these things going. And, you know, just from the mechanics, just to keep them up, doing software updates. I think there's a whole career industry of people, just like we have people maintaining cars, there's going to be maintaining these AIs. And robots are going to be a huge, huge thing.
So it seems like we'll have kind of AI platforms that become the tool set that people can use to blend it with whatever industry they're working in. So if you, you know, are a painter, you could figure out, you know, how to use the AI. So does it make sense that that would be a really smart career path for any young person to go down, no matter what industry?
Yes, right. If you have any inclination towards the technical, AI is certainly, I mean, you might have heard that, you know, there's very few AI postdocs. They're hired long before they ever make it a postdoc. So a lot of the academics are complaining that no one's getting their doctorate degree in AI because they're just hired sometimes even before they finish their bachelor's degree at, you know, six, even seven figures. So it's like totally insane. But even, you know, with not even that, if you can buy AI right now, and this is one of the things I'm saying, is that AI will be like electricity of the future, where it's a commodity, it's served out on the cloud, on the grid. You can right now go into AI, go into Google, get into TensorFlow, and you can start messing with it, and you'll learn more in 6 months fooling around with AI that you can purchase, and you'll become an expert. I mean, there are no AI experts right now. Everyone's just trying to figure this out. And so it's not difficult to actually very, very quickly have more knowledge than 0.1% of the entire planet, just by fooling around with AI that you can purchase on through Microsoft or IBM or Google. It's very cheap. You know, you can buy AI to do image processing, you can do so much with it just right now, just buying, filling, playing around with it. Like you would be experimenting with electrical stuff in your basement, you can be experimenting with AI, and you would gain more knowledge and more valuable career reputation than going to school.
And you mentioned TensorFlow. Is that one you would recommend starting with?
The TensorFlow has become kind of one of the default, we'll call it a language platform. In fact, Google is now making chips where the TensorFlow chips. So they're there's enough of it that, so Google is making its own AI chips. And the TensorFlow came from Google, and so it's becoming robust enough that they've embedded it into chips, the TensorFlow architecture.
Cool.
And it's becoming a little bit kind of the default framing for a lot of the neural net AI. And there, since we're getting technical, I just want to emphasize that all the advances, all the stuff we've heard about AI these days has come from only one type of possible AI. So we have in our own brains, we don't have a single dimension of intelligence. We have multiple kinds of intelligences. We have multiple kinds of cognition. One of the kinds of cognition that we have is called perception. It's tied with our eyes and ears, and it allows us to recognize patterns. It's how we see faces. It's how we recognize where we're going. And the neural nets, which are kind of imitating some of the structure of neurons in silicon, the neural nets are where all the AI that's being done today that you see examples of, including the driving cars, it's all relying on that one type of computation called neural nets, deep learning neural nets. There are layers and layers of these neurons connected together. And they, once they get some answer, they send it up to the next layer. The next layer parses a little bit more. So they have maybe 10 deep. And that is called the deep learning neural net. And almost all that the AI today is being done on that. And besides needing a parallel processing chip, which turns out that the video game chips were the main one that they discovered how to do this, the other requirement that besides this parallel chip that the GPUs, the game chips were made for, the second thing they needed was huge amounts of data. You had to train these with millions of examples. It's the only way they worked. So that wasn't possible till 5 years ago when people like Google and Amazon and others had these huge data sets. They had millions of examples of all kinds of things. And so that's what was used, that is what's used to train the neural nets, is you have a million examples of a million pictures labeled cat and a million pictures labeled a dog. And then you could teach this how the difference between a cat and a dog. So to drive down the street, you need to have like a million examples of streets. Well, Google has that. They've got the Google Earth. And so that's what they're using to train the neural nets in the self-driving cars. The reason why I mentioned that is that that's not the only way to learn. That's just one way. And out of all the kinds of cognition we have in our brain, perception is just one of them. We have in our own brains, we have deductive reasoning, we have inductive reasoning, we have long-term memory, we've got a spatial navigation, symbolic reasoning. We can't do any of those in AI right now. Okay, we don't know how to do small data intelligence. So a human toddler can tell the difference between cat and dog after 12 examples. So there's all kinds of things that we don't know how to do that are opportunities for somebody in the future. So TensorFlow is about neural nets. It's about this old way where you have millions of data points and you have these neural nets that are on a chip. That's how Google and the other companies are all doing their AI right now, but it's only one way. We have a whole frontier. We have a huge opportunity to discover the other kinds of cognition, how to do symbolic reasoning, how to do logic, how to do common sense. We don't know how to do any of those in AI right now, which means that somebody has to invent them. So, the opportunity is for someone to come up with alternative ways to an alternative cognition to synthesize and to make it artificial, to discover and invent. So in the realm of big data sets and neural nets, it's cheap. Anybody can go in there. You can fool around. It's going to be in demand. There's no shortage of. It's a very flat way. It's like going back to it's the bottom way. It's this very brute, flat way at the bottom. It's not very efficient, but we can go further than we ever thought, and we haven't reached the end of it. So there's plenty of things to use that for and discover. It's not going to get us all the way to where we want to go. We need other kinds, but it will take us further than we thought. And it's a huge opportunity for anybody to kind of mess around with because it's very easy to get into. If you're really ambitious, what you want to do is you want to invent these other varieties of cognition, which we don't know how to do yet, which will be very important as well.
Do you know of any companies that are quite advanced in those different or are starting to get somewhere? So I'm guessing then the AI that learned all those Atari games would be the one you're talking about.
Okay. Yeah, it's a neural net that played thousands of games.
Yeah.
The ones that are doing the synthetic faces that just came out the other day from NVIDIA. Same thing. NVIDIA is also making their own AI chip, but it's running neural nets. It's doing perception, and it can actually generate a human face in its most particulars of freckles and things that does not exist, that looks totally, totally 100% convincing. You'd simply understanding. So that's all neural nets. So there's a lot that can be done with the existing AI technology today, but from where we want to go and all the things, there's this huge mountain of things that are ahead of it. And, you know, talking about premature optimization, I suspect that the companies that will do this won't be the current companies, the Googles and IBMs, because they're gonna optimize onto this stuff right now. They're gonna perfect this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there just seems to be so much opportunity with this one version.
Yeah, like, right.
Yeah. Hmm. Do you think there'll be conscious AI in the future?
Well, see, intelligence, consciousness, creativity, none of these are binary. Intelligence. It's not like something's intelligent or not. First of all, there's many different dimensions of intelligence, and all of them are gradations. All of them are continuums. Same thing with consciousness. There are many types of consciousness. It's not binary. It's not like you're conscious or you're not. It's not like you have this one kind of conscious or you don't. It's like there's many varieties of consciousness. There are many gradations of them. So right now, humans have one kind of consciousness. Gorillas have another kind of consciousness. Porpoises, dolphins have another kind of consciousness. To some extent, dogs have some variety of consciousness. So yes, the answer is, of course, machines will have varieties of consciousness. And the way that that's coming right now is one of the challenges for AI is that they make decisions and we don't know how they made their decisions, right? So they have these deep neural nets, these deep learning things, and they come out with like, okay, this is a cat. You ask, well, why did you decide that was a cat? What's the reasoning? And they have no idea. They have no way to express that. They have no way. We can't look at the code. It doesn't make any sense. So making cat or dog, that's fine. But these are just AIs are using to make mortgage decisions about who gets the mortgage or who doesn't, or probation, life and death kind of a sense. So how do they decide? Are they biased? And sometimes they are biased. And so there's a movement now to have something called explainable AI. And it's like the AI, we have to understand how it reaches that conclusion. So the only way that that's being done is there's another AI.
That's what I thought.
That's programmed to look at that AI and explain how it got its answers. That is the beginning of consciousness.
Yeah. No kidding.
Okay. That's what consciousness is. We're conscious because we can actually reflect on our own processes and articulate what it is that we think. So that's how it begins. There are different levels, and as they get better, they will be able to, the two will work together, and you'll have something that's aware of what it thinks and how it thinks. So that'll be one variety of consciousness. And that's actually being mandated and required now.
Wow.
There's a Pentagon program and others who are, and there's a whole movement of people saying that you can't have these things that make these very important decisions unless they have this module, this consciousness aspect that can actually tell us how they make the decisions.
Wow. Huh. That's very cool. Huh. What has you clearly are passionate about this subject. What has you most excited right now in this field?
There's a very vibrant, huge network of people who are concerned about the ethics and morality and taking very seriously. There's a emerging discipline called AI safety. People who, and that's the broad term for kind of directing the AI. The ethical implications, you know, self-driving cars, the biases that can be introduced, and kind of the fear of the runaway aspect of it. That's very exciting, and for this reason, and that is because it turns out that it's actually not difficult to instill into AIs or machines ethics, morality. Ethics is basically software. It's like
it's kind of a rule set, isn't it?
Yeah. So rule set. It's like code. So it's made to absorb that. It's like law is just code. So you can very easily just put in the rule set into AIs. The difficulty for us has been is that human ethics and morality are very superficial. We're very shallow. We're very inconsistent. We actually don't even know. You know, like the trolley problem. We don't even have an answer. So. And so the difficulty is for humans to know what it is. And so in order to program into AIs, we have to actually get better at it. We actually have to improve our own ethics and morality. It's like being a good parent, like when you try to teach your kid to become better. So the thing that's exciting is that we're actually going to, the AIs are actually going to make us better humans.
Wow.
Right? They're going to up our game because we have to become better, more consistent, more articulate, more fair in our ethics in order to put it into the machines. And I think that's exciting.
Right. Like the, you know, we talked about the meta university and this is the meta mentor that teaches you how to be a better human.
Right.
Amazing. Wow.
Yeah, I think the wheels are going to be turning on this for a couple of days.
Yeah.
Before we kind of round the bend on this interview, I'd like to talk a bit about decentralization and what society looks like in a decentralized format.
Well, first of all, with all these AIs, what does decentralized AI look like? Because right now, a lot of the AIs are kind of created by companies and maintained by companies?
Yeah, it's a good question because I think a lot of the AI, if it becomes a service, a utility, will not be centralized. It will obey the network effects. We'll have some very dominant AIs because AIs, like other things in the network economy, have what we call network effects, meaning the more that they're used, the smarter they get, more people want to use them, more people that use them, the smarter it gets. So you have this compounding, increasing returns, and there'll be some very, very big, dominant AIs for sure. So there is a aspect of listening to the technology that says that, I would say within one type of AI, they'll have a few dominant players. So the decentralized, where it'll be decentralized though, is that I think there's a discrepancy or a disagreement about whether the AI is all going to be in the cloud or how much is going to be in the local machines. You know, your car, your glasses, or the vacuuming robot. And right now the vision is kind of like a hybrid version where some of the intelligence is in local, decentralized in that sense, and some of it is being shared on the cloud. And because really it's the cloud that makes things smarter and smarter. I mean, the whole point of an AI is that unlike human, it can learn from all the other Roombas, right? So if every Roomba is learning and then you just share what every Roomba learns, then you have this, that's the sharing world. That's the collaboration that's possible where you have aggregate learning. You're learning in a community, in a network learning. It's like very, very powerful. That comes because there's cloud. But it doesn't have to be all the time. It could be half connected sometime, so forth. So there is an opportunity for the decentralization and that kind of local aspect. There's also a chance for decentralization in the varieties of AI. Again, if you it's, you know, the niche, right? So like it doesn't, we don't there'll be advantages to having different ways of thinking. And so they could be decentralized. But I think more realistically, what I'm guessing the decentralization might come from is kind of the AR world, the world in where we embody this AI. So the AI is abstract. It's kind of intelligence. It's flowing. It's not really useful to us unless it is brought into the world in some way through a device like a robot or through some interface where we get to interact with it in some ways. You know, in the movie Her, it was just an earpiece and it was just something whispering in your ear. But there are other ways that this AI can, that we can interact with that intelligence. And I think it's going to be the AR world, the world of the mixed reality world, where it'll understand our gestures. We can listen to it. Maybe there's avatars that we can interact with. And that world, the 3D represented world, wants to be decentralized. It's kind of like the internet because it's all the local, your house probably will be the information, the scan of that house is probably something that you want to control, or maybe you serve up inside your house is sort of something that you want to fit into the rest of the world, but you want to have in some ways some control over that. So I think the manifestation, I think there may only be, you know, few companies making AIs, but I think the manifestation of that will be decentralized. And there's some opportunity for us to decentralize the manifestation of that intelligence. The intelligence alone is just disembodied and will probably be obey the network effects, but the interaction of the AI is something that can be decentralized. So it's sort of like, yeah, electricity is flowing, it's made in a couple of places, but all the motors that run it, all the devices that consume it are not owned by the same. Those are decentralized in that sense.
Do you worry about censorship being a problem when a couple of entities control access to everything and people don't own anything themselves? You know, if somebody speaks out against the government and then the government is lobbying this company and they say, hey, okay, shut down this person's access.
Yeah, that will be a problem. And one of the things that we've sort of realized in the past 5 years is that, you know, these institutions like Google and Facebook are quasi-governmental institutions. They have reached, or they have grown to the point where they have many of the attributes of a government, yet they're corporations. And we don't have a good conceptual fit for them. We don't have good ways to regulate them. We don't know what they are yet. We haven't really kind of absorbed or reckoned with the fact that we have these quasi-governmental institutions that have taken a lot of the things that governments used to do, and now they probably have to act in that way. And we're set up as corporations, and so we're at a kind of a disjointed moment. So I think in the long term, these platforms will probably have to have a new category for them. They're more than corporations. They're more than governments. They're these other things. These are platforms, and then we will have to evolve a set of rules for them, including this question about censorship, because censorship was much more of a kind of the laws of our world and our country about censorship all had to do with government censorship. There was no sense of censorship from individual companies. They weren't even on the. They weren't even in the picture. The legal protection against censorship was all about government. So if these are kind of new forms of government, then we kind of have to have some new understanding, shared understanding with them about what's their rights and responsibilities. Do we want them to censor certain things like hate speech or nothing? What do we want? And the answer is we don't know right now. We don't have. We haven't yet figured out what it is, because we don't know to what extent we want them to act as a government. And that's, so yes, I think that's something we're in the process of trying to figure out. Do we want them?
It seems like we started earlier talking about governance and future forms of governance. Maybe this kind of more agile model of, you know, technological kind of quasi-governmental entities is how we can test these different governance models, and we can see how much censorship is too much or not enough. Because, you know, if on one hand you can have like the dark web where almost nothing is censored, and then on the other hand you have some sort of totalitarian, you know, Chinese social score system where you could be censored for saying the wrong thing.
Sure.
Where is the happy middle?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, you could see that as a rehearsal for something. That, maybe that is one way to think about it. At the same time, you know, do we want those companies and their unelected officials to act as a government? And that we don't. I mean, I don't know. I don't know myself what my own opinion about that is.
Yeah. Do we want Jeff Bezos in charge of our global food supply? Do we want Zuckerberg deciding how we communicate?
Even if we just keep it to censorship, you know, that's a good question. Should these people decide what we say or not say? And in some cases, we do want that control. We don't want hate speech, or do we? Should we allow that? I mean, should they be the one deciding what it is or not? So, but I think for me, what I think we shouldn't do is penalize them for trying something or not trying something, whatever it is, as a moral failure, which is, I think, is what's going on right now.
Right. It seems like some sort of hybrid model might be very valuable, where you have a combination of elected officials, sort of, you know, experts, governance experts, and then the technologists who actually build the platform, and then the people who use the platform that also have a say.
Yeah, I think anybody who touches it should have some right and responsibilities, some stakeholding in it. But that's, you know, I mean, again, that's we saw a little bit, you know, there's a movement right now, maybe having shareholders, employees who are shareholders in the Silicon Valley model, have more of a say in things. And perhaps maybe there's a new view of customers using it. So it remains to be seen. We could kind of imagine different models being tried. I do think that there's more likely that these, we'll call them platforms, these some people call them QNOs, quasi, or QGOs or something, quasi-governmental organizations, these new platforms, will probably be much more likely to be able to try stuff, try new models of organization and shareholder representation and things like that. So it's potentially possible.
Do you see any good examples of the employee-owned company working yet?
No, but again, I mentioned this guy, Brave New Work, Aaron Dignan. He talks about that in his book, all the examples where he could find of these kinds of alternative organizational models.
Perfect. That's the next book.
What makes you personally the most optimistic about the future?
History, as I said, I try to read as deep as I can. And I think also my kids. I think looking at the young people, seeing what they're interested in, how they feel about the world, how they believe things are possible, that gives me optimism.
Hmm. Great answer. Kevin, thanks so much for joining us. This has been a lot of fun.
This
has been very valuable.
Great. I hope you enjoyed it. And thanks for having me on.
All right, this was the second part of our interview with Kevin Kelly. For all the links and show notes, go to futurethinkers.org/85 or check the description of this video if you're watching on YouTube. And for part one, go to futurethinkers.org/84. And if you want to stay up to date with our latest episodes, blog posts, or news from Future Thinkers, join our mailing list at futurethinkers.org/mailing-list. To meet like-minded people, join our Future Thinkers Discord community. Go to futurethinkers.org/discord. Don't forget to subscribe and hit the bell icon to get notified of new videos. You can also follow us on social media to stay connected. If you'd like to get a t-shirt like the new Make America Think Again, go to futurethinkers.org/store. If you like what we do and you want to help us make more podcasts and videos, consider donating or becoming a patron at futurethinkers.org/support. Also visit our sponsor Qualia and use the coupon code FUTURE to get 10% off your purchase.
This episode is brought to you by Qualia, a nootropic supplement that helps support mental performance and mood. To get 10% off, use the code FUTURE at checkout. And to learn more about neurohacking, visit futurethinkers.org/neuro.